Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, an interesting story of the man who was once known as Santa Claus's secretary, a New Yorker who founded the Santa Claus Association, John Gluck. For years, letters from New York City children to Santa via the U.S. Post Office were routinely destroyed. But Gluck's idea to pair wealthy donors with deserving children in poverty caught on with the public, and through most of the 19-teens and 20s was incredibly successful. Gluck became a Jazz Age celebrity with plans to build a Santa Claus monument in the center of Manhattan. He became famous, but he also became wealthier, and investigations into the Santa Claus Association eventually found a Scrooge at its heart. The story of the Santa Claus Association, its ascent and descent, as well as its influence on nonprofits and government organizations since and today. Did you know the state of Oklahoma has a Santa Claus commission that provides for state wards? Well, that influence continues, and it's at the heart of the story of the book, The Santa Claus Man, The Rise and Fall of a Jazz Age Con Man and the Invention of Christmas in New York by Alex Palmer, who's my guest today. Palmer tells that story as well as that explosion of the popularity of Christmas that took place in the early 20th century, how many of our biggest Christmas traditions began during that time. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Alex Palmer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
The story of the Santa Claus Man is really a story from your own family. John Gluck Jr. is a distant relative.
Yeah, that's right. He's somebody that we sort of talked about in the family. We knew about having this distant relative in New York who had started this group that answered Santa letters. We even had this funny ad that Seagram's ran in the 70s that included him among all these other holiday sort of Christmas celebrities, that, like the guy who invented the Christmas card or Clement Clark Moore who wrote "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," and there was John Gluck who saved a lot of children's Christmas wishes. So we only knew a little bit about him in the family, that he just did this good thing. And I thought that was an interesting story just as a writer and journalist. I thought this would be a fun story to tell. So I started researching it and realized there was so much more to it.
Now, what was John Gluck before he got into the publicity business and before he started the Santa Claus Association? He was kind of a businessman. What was his trade? Was he an actuary, or I'm trying to remember?
Yeah, he was a customs broker. He kind of inherited that from his father, was in the customs broking business. And he went into the family business, and when his father passed away, he took over the company, but never really enjoyed it particularly. It wasn't really something he liked the business aspect of it, but he also had this real wild imagination or real creativity that he wanted to direct elsewhere. He wanted to really excite and engage people, and that's where he started shifting into publicity. While still doing the customs broking, he started taking over publicity gigs, doing kind of interesting projects here and there. One of his most high-profile ones was running the promotion for a Coney Island bullfight. So that sort of thing was a lot more fun than the everyday customs broking kind of work was.
And you said that this Coney Island bullfight, even in 1912 and 1913, the Humane Association was already protesting, and it was supposed to be a bloodless bullfight, but I guess the bull ran into the side of a wall and stunned himself.
Yep.
And it became an utter fiasco. But out of that experience, he was hooked.
Right. He saw this opportunity. This was really getting the press writing about him, even though it was a disaster. There was, you know, crowds running everywhere. They're frightened of the bull, and he ended up arrested as a result of this for animal cruelty, even though he was an animal lover himself. But things did not go as planned with this bloodless bullfight. But he came out of that with this real sense of the value of publicity and the excitement that he could create with the right compelling story. This was a packed crowd at this arena in Coney Island, and got all kinds of newspapers writing about it. And he really saw the power of the press, and it was something that he took from that moment. That really was where you can see him deciding that doing the Santa Claus Association would be a logical next step and something that would be a lot of fun to jump into.
How did he get the idea for the Santa Claus Association?
It was kind of a combination of things. It had been a lot of back and forth with the post office whether they wanted to even allow Santa letters to be released. And that was a surprisingly controversial point for the first 15 years of the 20th century. It really, there was a lot of different stances. Some thought that they should all be released, that it was a tragedy to just destroy these children's wishes. Others thought that it was a dangerous idea if you just let anybody answer these letters, you know, who's to check whether these kids actually needed it, whether the children's addresses would, you know, and their privacy would be protected. There was a lot of back and forth. Finally, the post office decided that they wanted to be on the right side of Santa, so they allowed to release the letters to groups that were approved by the local postmaster. And Gluck knew that he needed, he saw this as a fun opportunity, but he also knew that he needed to do a good job with it. He needed to be very exacting about answering these letters, needed to verify the addresses to protect the group, to ensure that they wouldn't get shut down or that these concerns about privacy and accuracy wouldn't become an issue. So he combined his business acumen with his imagination and created this association that really was a pretty complex organization to match children's Santa letters with donors and New Yorkers that wanted to give to these kids that wrote these really sweet letters.
How many letters was it? 500 or
500? Kind of when the group first launched, yeah. Mm-hmm. The post office for that season, it had about 500 in their stock that had come in.
And so he got a whole group of volunteers together to vet the letters to see if they were real, truly in need. Then he would match them up with donors, and then the donors would try to fulfill the wishes.
Yeah,
it sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And what could go wrong? It seems and people got really excited about it. Not only was it these volunteers of just, you know, the average New Yorker would hear about this program and say, that's a lot of fun, I'd love to answer a letter. They'd get a letter mailed to them asking for a doll or for a teddy bear, and they could personally answer that letter, get the toy that the child asked for. So it's a really nice, cheerful experience, and it caught on beyond just the volunteers. There were celebrities involved. John Barrymore took part in a benefit performance of one of his plays where all the money went to the Santa Claus Association to cover the cost of postage. He had Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks helped to launch its season in the 1920s. So there really was a lot of enthusiasm from not just the average New Yorkers, but the elites.
And it started out in the upstairs area above a restaurant where actually Gluck had a room there, I guess, or an apartment there.
That's right. Yeah, his friend Paul Hankel ran a chop house, a steakhouse in the theater district of Manhattan. So he was helping Gluck out, and Gluck stayed there. This was pretty common. There was a lot of restaurants that would actually have places you could live on the upper levels. So he lived there, and his friend Paul helped him out with some extra space where he launched the Santa Claus Association. He had this back office he wasn't using, so they were really crammed in there. There's a couple photos in the book. You can really see how there's not a lot of room in the back office. And even today, interestingly, and anyone who comes to New York or is a foodie in New York may know Keene's Chop House, which one of the mainstays that's been around forever. Paul Hankel actually had previously worked at Keene's and then started this chop house. He returned to Keene's after that, but this really, this operation was very similar to what Keene's was like. It was even just a couple doors down from it.
Yeah. Now, the whole thing about this book is it tells all sorts of stories about this particular age. This is taking place, 1913, 1914, right on the eve of World War I.
Right.
And really what you're seeing is probably by the late end of the 19th century, all of a sudden you're starting to see a commercialization of Christmas. Christmas becomes back in fashion, you know, first in England through Victoria and Albert, and then sort of moves across the pond. Christmas trees become an important part of the holiday. And you have all these traditions that we think of always being there. They really only date back 100, 150 years. And and really, this is the time when commercialization is sort of popularizing the image of Santa Claus. And Santa Claus Association sort of capitalizes on this commercialization that's going up around the holiday. Is that a fair assessment? Well, give us a sense of how Christmas was celebrated in the very early 20th century when the Santa Claus Association began.
Yeah, it was really shifting over, as you were saying, into being this commercial juggernaut that we know Christmas today. The same year the Santa Claus Association launched was the year that a public citywide Christmas tree celebrations just exploded. The 1912 was the first year New York had what now would be the Rockefeller Center tree, but at the time was in Madison Square Park. It was the first time really the whole city gathered around a tree and celebrated in this way, it was a fairly new phenomenon to have the entire city gathering around. And the following year, it was so popular, 50-plus cities started doing the same thing. Soon the White House had their own, and it continued. Similarly, Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, it's covered in there too, which is kind of now the sort of kickoff of the Christmas season. It was 1922, I believe, 22 or 23 was the first year they had their celebration as well. But at the time, there was the department stores. Macy's sort of did it bigger than anybody, but at the time, there had been this bubbling up with a lot of department stores had been introducing in-store Santa Clauses, in-store parades, more and more extravagant ways to acknowledge the holiday and to get people into their stores. Part of it, I think, was that the mass media was really exploding at the time. There was more newspapers were being released at the time in New York than at any time previous or since, really. And that those first decades of the 20th century was kind of the height of this new mass media, where there was sales being offered and great images and photos of toys and exciting things. So it was really the time where the idea of gifting was saturating Christmas. There was even the same year as the Santa Claus Association started, there was this group called SPUG, the Society for the Prevention of Useless Gifting, that launched with Teddy Roosevelt was one of their members, that giving had gotten so out of control that this group actually had to try to encourage people to not give unless it was really important. People were getting upset that they were having to give to coworkers and friends and everybody. There was so much money being spent on gifts that they were going broke.
Well, the first year of the Santa Claus Association, it sounds like it worked beyond anybody's wildest ideas, and especially Gluck. I mean, he had 500 donors. He had people donate postage to send letters and things mm-hmm. like that out. And it seemed like it was working pretty well. And in fact, one of the things he went into this, he says, I want it to work better, because there'd been other attempts to do this around the country, and they'd all failed miserably. Mm-hmm. And yet, in the first years of the first decades of the Santa Claus Association, it seemed to work beautifully.
It did. And it really, because he came in with this business background, he was able to really create a group that, when concerns would be raised about, well, how accurate is it, he could say, well, we have these volunteers who are investigating each letter, and we have this process where we verify the address and we make sure that there's not a duplicate. He really was able to show how organized the group was, and that really had wide appeal. So you had the business set that wanted to participate. He got donations from William Vanderbilt, among others. So there was really support from that side of it, as well as the more, you know, the society ladies and the folks who really thought it was a touching story. So it went, yeah, beyond the biggest challenge in their first year was just the volume of letters that started pouring in, just being able to coordinate them all. But it proved there were enough generous New Yorkers out there who wanted to be part of this. It went so well in the first couple of years that he just started having bigger and bigger ambitions from there. What began as 500 letters their first week that they started was soon tens of thousands. I think they had 28,000 that they answered in their first year. So it just grew from one year to the next.
And it seemed to work pretty well for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And John Gluck became a celebrity of sorts and during the Jazz Age, during the 1920s.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a big profile done on him in the New York Times Magazine. He was known as Santa's secretary, or the Santa Claus man, which is where I got the title for the book. He became this spokesman for Christmas. The biggest high-profile thing, kind of the pinnacle, as his ambitions seemed to grow with this, once he got the actual system of answering Santa letters going so well, he started to look for other opportunities. So beyond benefit shows that he would do, getting celebrities, King Bagot, who's one of the biggest silent movie stars of the day, actually dressed up as Santa to help him promote their 1914 season. And then in 1915, he announced on Christmas Day that the group would be funding a Santa Claus building in the middle of Manhattan. It was going to be this monument to Santa Claus that was going to have this giant stained glass Santa, would be designed by Edward and George Bloom, who were some of the, you know, the premier architects of the time, was going to provide this space for a trade show floor for toy manufacturers, while also serving charity work for children. So really extravagant. And when that was announced, it was a media explosion. There was clips I found from across the country, and, you know, as far as Portland, Oregon, there were clips about it, and at the time as well, newsreel clips about this announcement. They put so if you went to a movie at the time, you would have seen clips about this Santa Claus building across the country.
My guest today is Alex Palmer. He's an author of nonfiction, and it was a distant relative that spurred the inspiration for his book, The Santa Claus Man, The Rise and Fall of a Jazz Age Con Man and the Invention of Christmas in New York, a story of John Duval Gluck, Jr., who formed the Santa Claus Association in New York, and for 15 years this charity flowed. But I think you just sort of opened the door, because in the first years of the Santa Claus Association, there was very little money involved. There was money for postage, but it was really a matter of donors providing the money for gifts, which they purchased themselves.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, the money is starting to flow to the Santa Claus Association itself.
Yeah, and one of his big selling points at the beginning, what distinguished the Santa Claus Association, was that there was no overhead. This was all volunteers. Anybody that wanted to donate could just get a letter. They would see what the kid wanted, and they could give the kid that. So there was really all that was involved was a few volunteers having to shuttle letters to willing donors. So beyond the 2-cent postage stamps, really not a lot of money involved. But Ben Gluck began asking for financial donations rather than just gifts, saying, well, maybe can we get some more money for postage? Stamps are actually more expensive than we expected. Then it was, maybe you can donate money to help pay for our gift buying committee. We have experts at what gifts children would want, and if you cut us a check, we can fund that and see that the child gets the gift. So it was shifting away from that direct donor buying a gift for a kid and giving it to him. And then the announcement of the Santa Claus building came along with a request for funds, saying that it would cost $300,000 to fund this. And any mother that believed that their child should have faith in Santa would want to cut a check, was the pitch that he made. So really just put this call out to the whole country to cut a check, help fund this Santa Claus building, which people did. The money started rolling in, and something about Santa, he found people didn't ask a lot of questions. They thought this was a great idea, and they wanted to help any way they could.
Was the association actually helping a lot of families during its heyday? I mean, was it how many families was it helping?
They were. As far as it's hard to tell with the numbers, because Gluck would claim these numbers, but it was somewhere in the thousands, even tens of thousands of letters every year that would be answered, and a good number of those were really being helped. They were people that otherwise a kid would write a letter, otherwise it would have been destroyed in the dead letter office. So the group did save these letters and did get the kids connected the kid with the willing donor. So there were gifts being brought to children. There were reports in the papers that reporters would actually go with a volunteer or a donor to the household in, an old tenement building or one of the more impoverished areas of town, and be able to watch a child receiving the gift from the Santa Claus Association. So there were actual gifts being brought to families, some stories about even donors helping to pay for rent or helping the father find a job if he was out of work, and those sort of stories. So there, some of it was anecdotal, but there was a lot that was actually good being done.
No, but there was so much money coming in, eventually it began going other places.
Exactly, and that's where things started getting questionable, because one of the big selling points of this was how little overhead was required. Gluck would really distinguish the Santa Claus Association from government relief efforts, which involved a lot of bureaucracy, red tape, and distance between the person in need and the willing donor. But what the Santa Claus Association lacked, maybe it didn't have any overhead, but that also meant there was nobody watching where this money was going. Gluck was the secretary. He was the head of the treasury. He was the head spokesperson. He pretty much did everything. Despite the many volunteers, few of them really knew what was going on with the finances. So there was no real oversight to how this money was being spent and where it was going.
Well, there's also a lot of different stories you tell in this book. One of the most interesting to me was about some of his early volunteers, which he used a group of Boy Scouts. Now, we think of the Boy Scouts as the singular Boy Scouts of America. But I guess in the early part of the 20th century, there were rival groups of Boy Scouts, which was really quite interesting to me. I never heard this story.
Yeah.
And this particular a group of Boy Scouts. They sounded like they were quite militaristic. They were actually carrying weapons.
Right.
And
well,
that was part of the thing. It was they were being trained to be the future military of America.
Right. It was seen as a really patriotic thing. And yeah, at the time, the Boy Scouts of America had launched, and then this group, they originally called the American Boy Scouts, so very close to the Boy Scouts of America, but later renamed the United States Boy Scout, were started just a couple months after the original Boy Scouts of America. And there were a few other groups as well, but this was really the most prominent rival to the Boy Scouts of America. And as you said, they really distinguished what they were doing from what the Boy Scouts of America were doing by saying, well, we're the militaristic one. We're the ones preparing children to be soldiers, to serve their country. It was seen as a very patriotic thing, but it had the side result of giving all these kids rifles.
Weapons.
Some of them were, you know, 8, 9 years old. And so there were one accident after the other was being reported. There was a few really high-profile shootings that happened of one 8-year-old shot a 10-year-old, I believe, and killed him. And there were a few of those. And it really gave the U.S. Boy Scouts some pretty bad press. But by connection, the Boy Scouts of America were getting bad press, too. So really they really came down hard on the U.S. Boy Scouts to try to prevent them from even using the Scout name. And their connection to Santa Claus Association, Gluck, saw these U.S. Boy Scouts who needed good press as this great resource for the group. He used U.S. Boy Scouts to actually go door-to-door and check in on the requests that the children wrote to make sure they were actually worthy recipients of Santa's generosity. So this was a value to the U.S. Boy Scouts because it helped them get good PR when they needed it, and it was a great help to Gluck and his Santa Claus Association because he had these free volunteers that could help him out.
And yet, by today's standards, there's this level of creepiness about this whole thing, about sending this Boy Scout over to check out the house to see,
yep,
you know, if these people are truly needy or not. That just sounds
right.
So bizarre.
Yeah, this little uniformed kid going up to the door and asking the parent if they can afford to pay for Christmas presents for their kid. It seems pretty invasive, but at the time it was seen as a sort of noble, patriotic thing.
Well, as I mentioned, this continued for a number of years, but eventually somebody started asking questions, a charity commissioner, basically. And so who was this charity commissioner, and why did they start asking questions about the Santa Claus Association?
Yeah, the commissioner, it was the charity commissioner, and then it became the public welfare commissioner, Bert Kohler, who was really an accountant at heart. He had run for governor at one point, but he'd been the city's comptroller prior to that, and really was all about auditing and verifying and investigating. So when he took over this role, he'd been in the position in 1918, he started it. He really made a name for himself as a reformer, just hammering these charity groups. Charity had gotten so out of control after the war. There was very little regulation. There was people on every street corner asking for money for various charitable, patriotic, or emotional causes. And he set out to put a stop to it. He wanted to, he required that licenses be had by anyone doing street soliciting. Then he tried to extend that out to anybody sending mailers. He came down on local charities, any wartime charities, tried to get them to verify their value, similar to the way Gluck was verifying whether the children asking for presents were worthy. He was doing this with charity groups. And soon, it didn't take long for him to then come across the Santa Claus Association and start wondering why there wasn't more overhead or verification of what they were doing.
And eventually this led to Gluck's downfall.
It did, yeah. So Kohler first just asked Gluck to come to his office and asked to see his books. Gluck was very shady about that, and this book kind of outlines what his, you know, all his tactics to avoid showing the books. And finally, after first having a confrontation with Gluck in his office that went on for hours, and then using the press to try to put pressure on Gluck, he sent an auditor over who was refused admission to the Santa Claus Association offices. By then, they were in the Knickerbocker Hotel. The auditor was kicked out of the Santa Claus Association offices. And finally, Kohler was able to get a hold of the documents, and what there was even was not that much, but he was able to look over their papers, and it became pretty clear that there was a lot of discrepancies, a lot of money that was not accounted for that could only be going into Gluck's pocket.
What was the reaction once this went public?
It was a significant backlash from the press, which really had been what energized the Santa Claus Association for much of its history, was the really positive media attention. But as the press does now, where, you know, it's happy to flip on somebody that's maybe been elevated by the same writers, they turned on him. So you had the New York Daily News particularly came out really hard on him and writing, you know, critical stories and publishing photos of Gluck, you know, coming out of Bert Kohler's office looking very sinister with his bowler and his waxed mustache. They exposed not only Gluck's questionable work with the Santa Claus Association, but he had been involved in a number of other schemes that had been exposed. The U.S. Boy Scouts he was using as a fundraising scheme by the time it finally got shut down. He had a citizen secret service that was this sort of fake version of the Secret Service that he was using, an anti-narcotics league, all kinds of different schemes that were essentially all serving the same purpose of sending mailers to people, asking them to donate to this worthy cause, but the money was going directly into Gluck's pocket, not really doing any charitable work.
Yeah, so that was the end of the Santa Claus Association. But Gluck does have a bit of a legacy. You write, this is, you know, if there's anything, for years, letters had gone to the dead letter office, and they just sat there. Mm-hmm. And with Gluck and the effort of a couple others, that changed. And you think of like the original Miracle on 34th Street, those sorts of moments sort of catalyzed people to want to answer those letters. And to this day, there are organizations that try to match donors or provide presents for those that can't afford it. And Operation Santa Claus today is another version of the Santa Claus Association with better oversight, perhaps.
Absolutely, yeah. You could even say it really grew out of the Santa Claus Association as a result of the Gluck's malfeasance. The Postmaster General sent out a changed a ruling to the Santa Claus letters, the first time he'd done it since he released the letters, saying we need to be extra careful about who we allowed it to answer the letters. Eventually, that just meant that the post office itself oversees the program, where now you can go to the same post office in New York City where Gluck was working out of, where he and the volunteers would go to pick up their Santa letters. You can still go there now. This beautiful, the James Farley post office on 8th Avenue, get a Santa letter and answer it. But now the address has been redacted and you need to show your ID. You bring your present to the post office and they will take it from there. So there's a lot more oversight. They have a whole process of making sure that the gifts go to the kids, but that privacy is protected, and it's really evolved from the system that was put in place by Gluck.
Well, it's a really fascinating account, not only of Gluck and the Santa Claus Association, but of the era and how Christmas became, well, the origins really of what Christmas is today really started in the early 20th century, and it's revealed in the book, The Santa Claus Man. Alex Palmer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich. Appreciate it.
Writer Alex Palmer is the author of The Santa Claus Man, The Rise and Fall of a Jazz Age Con Man, and The Invention of Christmas in New York. It's published by Lions Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.